Okay, good evening, everyone. It's 9 o'clock. It's March 2nd, 2020. This is the fifth of the classes on the Nitziv. We're supposed to go two more, although obviously after today, next week is Purim, so we'll continue after that. Before I begin, and we have a lot to do, I just want to answer a couple questions from last class and point out a few other things. The first thing I want to mention is something I just totally forgot, but it's worth noting. I mentioned that the Shiltos was not really studied. It's not part of the yeshiva curriculum, and that's something everyone knows. It's not part of the yeshiva curriculum today. What I didn't mention, and I forgot, was an interesting point that is noted by Rav Mazuz in one of his works. Most people know about the famous question that the Beis Yosef asked. It maybe is the most famous halachic question ever asked, and there's more answers to it than everything. Namely, why is Hanukkah 8 days? It should be 7 days. If the miracle was that it only had enough oil, the cruse of oil, to last 1 day, and it lasted 8 days, so then should be 7 days. And this, as I said, there's a whole sefer. I believe it's called Ner Meyer, or Ner Lameya, which gives 100 different answers. And there's many, many more answers for this. What Rav Mazuz meant pointed out is that that no one realized, and this shows you how the Shiltos wasn't studied, that the Shiltos really provides the answer for this in a way. Because and this is mentioned by, in the commentary by Rishaya Pick, and the Nitziv mentions it also, but no one studies the Shiltos, so no one refers to this. Namely, the Shiltos, and this is, if you're interested in seeing it, it's section 26, Shilta 26, in the Nitziv's edition. It's page 178. The Nitziv, his girsa here in the Gemara is v'lo hayabo hadlik afilo yomecha. They didn't have enough even for the first day, which means that even for the first day, it's a miracle. And that answers the question. And the Rav Yishaya Pick deals with that. And the Nitziv deals with that. The problem is that earlier in the Shiltos, it seems that he has the same girsa that we have. But that presumably was corrected. This seems to be an authentic girsa. Afilo Yomechad. And the fact that all the people who discusses it, no one refers to this, is a good proof that they really didn't, they weren't studying the Shiltos. Point number one. Second, okay, now for some questions. Someone asked me what I meant when I said last class that Reb Mogliver was the founder of Mizrahi. Wasn't Reb Rhinus the founder of Mizrahi? I mentioned both of them. Actually, Reb Rhinus is the founder of the political movement in the Zionist organization called Mizrahi, but Rav Mogliver founded an organization. I don't know what you call it, a propaganda organization, an organization to spread the ideals of what would become known as religious Zionism called Mizrahi. And that was, and in Mizrahi stands for Merkaz Ruchani. So the name begins with Rav Mogliver, and the political party is with Rabbi Rhinus. And two more things. Yes, I see Tzipora. Tzipora at the end of the class mentioned that Rabbi Libus in Beis Avi discusses saying the prayer for the state, and I went and I pulled it off the shelf there. He says that I believe it was mentioned that it could be like a hope that maybe it's we're hoping that it's the Reishit Tzmichat Gaulatenu. Well, I took out the volumes and I found it in volume 5. And unless I'm missing something, Tzipora, that's not what he says. He discusses this in Siman Chaf Dalet and in Siman Samach Tes. And in both of them, that's not the reason he gives. The reason he gives is that the people who oppose saying Reishis Smichas Kulaseinu because it's false messianism, it's all this stuff, he simply says, who knows? Mazaharash Bazen. What's the why are people getting confused? Shamala. We don't know. It could be, maybe this is what you meant, Sipor. It could be the Messianic beginning of the Messianic. It might not be, but it's clearly not. There's no kafira in any roe bazeh shum kafira chas v'shalom. And then he quotes the Ger Rebbe, who said when the state was declared, that the Geula of Yisrael comes, little by little. And we can see Rishalmi says that. And finally, the last point, someone asked me, I've mentioned a few times Rabbi Bleich, that we have no interest in people who don't want to be married halachically and convincing them to, or obviously forcing them to. Well, what did I mean by that? What am I referring to? Okay, here's the actual case. I won't give any details per se, so the person can't be identified, but there was a member of the Grus Kollel in Israel, and his brother, who had become completely irreligious, was getting married, and the guy who's now a rabbi studying in the Grus Kollel, wanted the brother wasn't going to have an Orthodox wedding, and he wanted to know, should he try to convince his brother, should he offer for his brother that he would do the wedding, namely a halachic wedding. And he asked Rabbi Bleich, and Rabbi Bleich said, if your brother asks you to do the wedding, we don't turn people away, so then you'll do the wedding. But there's no concept that, and there's no reason that he should offer to do this for his brother or try to convince his brother to have a halachic wedding, because the brother is not a halachic Jew, and the brother, there's no guarantee when they get divorced. If they get divorced, they'll have a get, and that's what Rabbi Bleich said. And I'd be shocked if there's any rabbi. Email me if I'm wrong on this. I'd be shocked if there's any Orthodox rabbi who thinks that this is something positive that we should, if we know people are getting married who aren't, Torah Jews, that we should try to convince them to get married halachically. But that is exactly what they do in Israel. Not only do they force them to get married, that. So I'll look if anyone comments, but the Rabbi Bleich said there is no such concept. And as far as I know, Rabbi Bleich is correct that there's no such concept of trying to convince people who don't want to get married and have no interest, luckily, to get married, because it leads to all the questions of Mamzerus. Okay, let us continue, and I'll come back to that. I'll get back to your question, Baruch, as well, your comment. Okay, we ended off, and this is where we're going to start. The Nitziv has a famous attack on what we can call religious extremism. And that's, you'll find it in the Meshiv Davar, Volume 1, Siman number 44. The tshuva is called Concerning Right and Left, Yamin U'Smol. And as I mentioned, you can find a translation of this in this article by Rabbi Howard Joseph. As swords thrust through the body, the Nitziv's rejection of separatism. It's not just separatism, we'll see, it's religious extremism in general. This is published in the Eidah Journal 1-1. And you can see it online. The situation was as follows. There was a group called Machzikei Hadas that existed in Galicia. And they put out a newspaper, incidentally, Machzikei Hadas. I saw today that this great, great site called the Hebrew Newspaper Project from Israel, which has so many of the old issues, they also include the Machzikei Hadas, although they're missing a number of issues. But this was an organization in Galicia, and the paper argued, by the way, Rachel Mannikin, who is a scholar in Maryland, she wrote her dissertation and a number of articles on this organization. But it argued for communal separatism. Now, communal separatism is not something you ever had in Poland. You never had it in Lithuania. We know it, of course, from Germany, and we know it from Hungary. So here they were trying to bring it into the larger Ashkenazic world. And in this article, arguing that Jews should separate, and those, if you're interested in why, in the whole notion and the question, why Jews didn't want to separate. First of all, in my book on Rabbi Chiyaka Weinberg, I give some references, and subsequent to that, Benny Brown has a very good article dealing with this issue of separatism in Lithuania and Poland. We've mentioned this in many of our prior classes, even in a place like Brisk and all these other cities. Everyone, it was one community, so you'd have the Bundist on the committee on the town council, together with the Agudist and the Mizrahi. The very notion of separate communities, as happened in Germany and Hungary, was unknown in Lithuania and Poland. Now, the author of the article, which the Nitziv is responding to, arguing for communal separatism, not only did he say that in explaining why you need communal separatism, he said that our generation is the worst there has ever been when it came to observance of the Torah. And the Nitziv thinks this is nonsense. He says, first of all, Just open up the Tanakh and you'll see that there were times when there were lots and lots of idolaters. So the idea that you always had pious people in the past, it's not true at all. On the contrary, in Tanakh you had loads of idolaters. I mean, if you just read Tanakh, it seems that the majority of people at many times were idolaters. So, although I always add that, I mean, people say idolaters. It's more complicated than that. I think there's another expression. They weren't idolaters in the sense that they just worshipped the Baal or anything like that. I think we have to assume that they were they were hedging their bets. In other words, they worshipped the God of Israel, but they also worshipped the Baal. I mean, if you want to make sure that you have a good rain, you need to worship the storm god. So it's not that they were totally abandoning the God of Israel. I think that what the correct understanding is that in addition to the God of Israel, they were also worshiping many of these other gods because they believed in them. And if they would have just worshiped the God of Israel, they would have been monolatrists. That is, you have idolatry, you worship lots of gods, and then you have monolatry, which is between monotheism and idolatry. Namely, you believe in a lot of gods, but you only worship one god. Their problem was that they were worshiping other gods as well as the God of Israel. But so the Nisiv thinks it's nonsense to say that our generation, that is his generation, is the absolute worst. He says what's significant, however, is that our generation, you have people with special heretical ideas such as rejecting of the Talmud. That is, they do not believe in the very notion of Torah Shabbat. In his day, they believed in Tanakh, but they didn't believe in the rabbis. So the author of the article in Machzik Yadas said that the way we can save ourselves is by separating from the non-religious. And when I say non-religious, I don't mean like today. You can have people who are not Orthodox who are religious, but these were people who I think you'd say non-religious. But the Nisiv rejects this as well. He says that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of the disputes between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the Sadducees were certainly Michutz l'machaneh, and it caused a lot of Sinas Chilim. I want to read you what he says. I'm quoting here from Joseph's translation. It's easy just to read from this. Now the author presents his thoughts and proposal to be careful of this generation and to separate completely from them as Avraham did from Lot when we were sovereign in our holy land. As during the Second Temple period, the land was lost, the temple was destroyed, and Israel exiled because of the dispute between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This caused much sinat chinam, leading to unjustified murder. Thus, when a Pharisee saw someone being lax in a certain matter, even though he was not a Sadducee, but only sinning in this matter, because of tremendous sinat chinam, he judged him to be a Sadducee who can be legitimately harmed. From this mistaken attitude, numerous allegedly justified and holy murders justified. And then he goes on to say that a member of the Machzik Yadas might see someone and imagine that he does not follow his way in proper worship of God. He will then judge him to be a heretic and separate from him. They will then chase each other, rodef, with intent to harm, in the erroneous belief that this is justified, God forbid, the entire people will be destroyed. What he is saying, and remember, we're talking about Sadducees. There's no question that Sadducees were heretics. What he's saying is that the battle between the Sadducees against the Sadducees led people who were not Sadducees, it led people to call others, to accuse others of being Sadducees when they were not. Just like today, they'll refer to people as conservative or open Orthodox, even if they're not. But that's a term of abuse. If you don't like them, you want to say you're outside the fold, so he's a conservative rabbi or something like that. The battle against the Sadducees led to Sinas Chinam and all the bad things. So this must mean that according to the Nitziv, that in dealing with Sadducees, there has to be a different way to deal with them. Because he's saying that the battle against the Sadducees, which we would assume is a valid battle, but it led to all sorts of negative consequences. So therefore, we should not battle the Sadducees the way we did. There has to be a better way. And he doesn't explain here, though, how. You know, how are you supposed to battle against the Sadducees? It's interesting that he brings an example from the Sadducees to make a point that no matter how sinful a Jew is, we shouldn't totally remove ourselves from him. His the upshot of what he argues is that when we deal with the outside world, we go together. And when we're among ourselves, we can battle. So what is the battle against the Sadducees? I think you have to understand him as saying that it went too far because it also had an outer connection with the Romans. Because what would be the problem of internal battle against the Sadducees? I mean, we know that they went to the Romans, that they were Malshinim and things like that, but I don't think the Pharisees are accused of that. It's a little interesting that he's views the Pharisees' battle against the Sadducees as a negative battle, because how does that differ from the Orthodox battling the Reform internally? I'm not talking about going to the government, which the Orthodox did do in the early Reform. They shut the temple down in Hamburg and things like that. But the Nitziv, I mean, we're not talking about going to the government, and the Pharisees, as far as I know, didn't go to the government to try to, unless you say because they all, they were concerned about control of the temple, etc., that they by definition they had to be involved with the king and the Romans. In any event, it's of interest and noteworthy that he uses the battle against the Sadducees as how you're not supposed to battle when dealing with heretics. He says, as we just saw, when you have disputes, people are inclined to place others on the outside. You place them outside of what today we call orthodoxy. And it's obvious that if we adopt the approach of the Machzikei HaDaas, we're going to say that our way is the correct way. Any way that's not like ours is outside the fold. You're not religious enough, therefore you're not orthodox. And of course, the Nitziv thinks that's not the proper approach. We must be united, otherwise we won't be able to survive. Of course, the Machzikei HaDaas approach would mean that people are not part of the Jewish people. We're just throwing them out. They're completely separate. Hirsch in Germany refused to have anything, and in Hungary as well, even when dealing with the government, they regard themselves as totally separate and would not join together, even for anti-Semitism, even in the early Hitler years. If you remember my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I translate there that, or I have translated that letter that the German separatist Orthodox wrote to Hitler in October of 1933 to say that we're not like these other Jews, these Reform Jews. Because we don't intermarry and we don't like to have it. We're not going to have excessive economic influence because we don't work on the Sabbath. This was before you had Jewish billionaires who were Shomer Shabbos. So that's the sort of thing that the Nitziv is very much against when dealing with the outside. We fight among ourselves, but we deal with the outside as one. And in fact, if you look at the Meshiv Davar in the same volume I found in number nine, Tshuva number nine. There he's dealing with a case of people who are not religious, and he's very harsh, not Shomer Shabbos. He doesn't even permit us to daven with them. Something that today people would find shocking, that you're not supposed to daven with them if they're not Mechal Shabbos Parhesia. We don't accept a karban from them, and therefore it's Tfilas El Toeva. We don't want to have anything to do with them. So don't join with them. Yesel he says having a synagogue together with them, absolutely not. We don't want to be with them. So that's internally, though, in terms of how we relate to them. Now, this basic idea of the Nitziv, that about disputes in among the Jews internally and externally, is found in a number of places, including I mentioned already, I think, in the introduction to HaMek Dever to Bereishis. There he says that people suspected others of being heretics and killed them. And he repeats this elsewhere in his commentary to Bamidbar 35:34, and especially in Devarim, chapter 4, Pasuk 14, he uses the expression killing beheter. In other words, you think that it's okay to kill them because they're deserving of it. And that's how he understands the Gemara. The Gemara says that the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. People thought that their neighbor was deserving of death. He was a heretic, and therefore it was permissible to kill him. And the source of this view was Sinas Chinam, as opposed to Bayit Rishon, the first Beis HaMikdash, when the murders there took place without theological justification, just that people were wicked. Not so in Bayit Sheni. I'll read from you a section of his commentary in a minute. in his elsewhere in his Maroma, in his commentary Maromi Sada on Shas in Yoma 9b, he explains that the murders in by Rishon were regular murders, not like in by Yesheni, where there was a theological justification, I should say religious reasons for hating your neighbor. Now, in the introduction to Bereishis, he says that God does not suffer these type of tzaddikim in quotes. I mentioned this already. Now, he's not speaking about the Sikarim or any of the extremists we know about. He's speaking about regular people. Let me read you what he says in his Harchev Davar on Devarim, chapter 4, number 14, where he says that the major sinners were Talmidei Chachamim and Gedolei Torah. Let me read you here. Now he picks up on this page here. He picked, what leads him to it? Well, in we get my Chumash out here in Parshas Ve'eschanan. It says in Perek Dalet, Pasuk, let me read you what it says. I'll just Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Dalet, and then tests of 14 and 15. It says God commanded me, Moshe, at that time to teach you statutes and ordinances. Well, made some mishpatim, also some in the land I'm giving you. And then the next pasuk it says, "V'nishmartem lo nafshaseichem." Take heed of yourself. What do you mean, take heed? Ki kol isem tmoduna. You never saw any grave. You never saw any form, any graven image, and it goes on. So you have the issue there of avodah zarah. What's the connection between pasuk 14 that I taught you chukim and mishpatim to do when you go into the land of Israel, and the fact that this prohibition against idolatry? Why are they right next to each other? And then the Nitziv says that that this is directed to both psukim are directed to the Talmidei Chachamim because it says I taught you chukim and mishpatim. Who do you teach chukim and mishpatim to? So the Nitziv says Shemaser la Talmidei Chachamim haoskim bechukim mishpatim, because it's the Talmidei Chachamim. They're the ones who have to be involved with this. Then why are you going to tell the Talmidei Chachamim about avodah zarah? No, he says, Talmid Chacham is, he can come to Hashchasas Avodah Zarah Yoser Mishar Anashim. You have to be worried about the Talmidei Chachamim and Avodah Zarah more than other people. Well, that's a strange thing to say. You might say, why would you have to be? And he explains it. He says, Talmid Chacham Alu Lavo Gama Hashchasas Avodah Zarah Yoser Mishar Anashim. No, the Talmid Chacham can fall into avodah zarah more than anyone else. And then he says, "Deroshei hamavim avodah zarah umachtim kol Yisrael hayu Yeravam Achav Menashe." He says that the leaders of avodah zarah in Nach were Yeravam Achav Menashe, shahayu Talmidei Chachamim gedolim. He says they were great Talmidei Chachamim, as he cites in Parachelik that says this. So we see that the Talmidei Chachamim could fall into this. And why? Why is the Talmid Chacham going to fall into this? He says, "Ba'asher she'Talmid Chacham b'chachmasa motzi drachim oros heter." The Talmid Chacham is able to twist himself into pretzels to come up with false heterim. U'afech divrohim chayim. He can come up with a false. We're not just dealing with a heretic. A heretic will do what they want, but the Talmid Chacham can come up with a way to. That's why the earlier reformers they thought they were so terrible because they can come up with halachic justifications. To, as the expression is, matara tasheretz, to permit anything. And then he goes on to say that that the Talmidei Chachamim have a special yetzer hara, melech neged haTorah al pi hataiva. Because everyone has a taiva, but the Talmidei Chachamim have a special yetzer hara because they can find justifications for it. The Yetzer Hara Shemata et Hadas, Achshav Shu Mitzvah. They can convince themselves that what they're doing, the terrible thing they're doing, is actually a mitzvah. We have plenty of examples of people who convince themselves that what they're doing is a mitzvah. And therefore, that he explains That's why the Gemara says that the Talmud Chacham, it says that his Yetzer Hara is bigger than us, other people. Why should the Talmud Chacham's Yetzer Hara? Everyone has a problem understanding that. Why should the Yetzer Hara of a Talmud Chacham be bigger than someone else? On the contrary, it should be smaller because he's a Talmud Chacham. But no, precisely because he has the ability to convince himself that what he wants to do, his Yetzer Hara, is really a Yetzer Tov. That's why a Talmud Chacham could be so dangerous, because if he turns to the dark side, who knows what it can be? V'zeh lo shayach ba'amaretz. The Netziv says the Am Haaretz is just going to do what he wants to do, but he's not going to twist the Torah because the Am Haaretz doesn't know Torah. The only people who can twist the Torah are the Talmidei Chachamim. That's why they also say not to be an apikoros, you really need to know things, because only an apikoros, because other people are just amaratzim, they don't know anything. To be an apikoros, you need to be a Talmud Chacham. And he continues, because people don't just go after Avodah Zarah. Who's going to do that? So his assumption is that they had justifications that really, we're not really going after the Avodah Zarah. We're just using it as intermediaries, etc., etc. And it's also terrible. It's worse. Why? The Talmud Chacham Shachot Nimshach Harav Harbe. Because many, the Talmud Chacham is able to bring people along with him. So it's not just an individual sin. And he can convince people what you're doing. Masha'en Kein Am Haaretz. But Am Haaretz, you don't need to worry. He's not going to bring anyone after him. Therefore, he continues to say that Moshe Rabbeinu has to stress that when he says it, Az Kein Hizir Moshe Rabbeinu to the Chacham B'Yoser. Moshe Rabbeinu has to speak dafka to the Talmidei Chachamim about to be concerned about Avodah Zarah. And he goes on. Then, and that this is all in the Amik Davar, and then in the Harchev Davar, his expansion of it. He continues what we were talking about before, that that in the in, just like in Bayit Rishon, in Bayit Sheni, Roshei HaMachtirim Gdolei Torah, the so too in Bayit Sheni. And where did this come from? He says, well, we know Sinas Chinam, but then he adds something original. He says the Sinas Chinam came from Avas Mamon Yoser Midayim. The Sinas Chinam actually comes from money. People were materialist and hungry for money. And because they were so interested in money, therefore this led them to hate their neighbor. And he brings a proof from a Tosefta in Menachos that it says, why were they exiled? You might think these are two separate things, that they want like money and they hate their neighbor, but he sees them as the same. And then he says that the love of money, which led to Sinas Chinam, also led to Shfichos Damim Be'eter. And that's that expression I said already. That then he says, Iker HaMachtim Gedolei Torah. And so in other words, they killed people not just for the sake of killing it, they were able to justify it. They were able to find a halachic justification for it. And then it continues with the point he made. So very fascinating elaboration and of the dangers of Talmid Chachamim going to the dark side, and the whole notion that that Sinas Chinam that leads to Shfichos Damim Beheter. Here he's speaking about literal Shfichos Damim, but also we can talk about figurative Shfichos Damim. That is, the phrase is used to embarrass people. The phrase is used to destroy people's reputation. And, oh, this guy, he has a different view than me, so therefore he's a heretic. And if he's a heretic, well, then you can treat him like every heretic, and you can humiliate him in public. You can embarrass him. You can show that he's a nobody and nothing. That's how people felt, and that's why, and then Siv spoke very strongly against it. Let me read you and show you another thing. The Netziv also says in his commentary on Shir HaShirim, chapter 8, verse 10, says something really interesting in showing how to relate to the less religious. He says that you should not separate from those who are not Baalei Torah, scholars. And even if they violate the Torah, you should yeshahafach b'zchut and try to find justifications for them. And then he quotes a novelist, Rabbi Nassan, that says you shouldn't say ehovat hachamim, love the chachamim, and hate the students, or even love the students and hate the Amay Aretz, but love everyone, but hate Usnei HaPikarsin v'Maasitim v'Medichin, but hate the heretics and the ones that lead people to sin. And then it says, and he elaborates on it, and says, Amay Haaretz, the ignorant, Afal Gaf Shehem Asonim u'Mevalzim u'Chachamim u'Talmidim, even though the ignorant hate the sages, and the Gemara already speaks about how they hate the sages. And Chazal called these people who hate the sages apikarsim. Nevertheless, mikomakom iyatar shai vavazototam uisnootam. The Nitziv says that although the sages refer to these people as heretics, you can't hate them because, you know, at the end of the day, they're amaratzim, and the reason they don't like the sages is because they don't know anything. We can instruct them, and they can learn things. They're not theological heretics, and therefore he says, even though these are heretics, apikorsim, according to the definition of the Talmud, iyashai rishai levazototam, vizototam, v'isnootam. We cannot hate them. Incredible. Now, before we go further, I want to show you something very interesting, which is not found in my book, Changing the Immutable. Those who don't know Changing the Immutable, here it is. I like to think that people who are listening to the classes know it, but it amazes me that how many people don't know. Like I'm asked, sometimes people ask me a question and they never heard of this book, they never heard of any of my books. Just today, I got an email from someone who writes me that his friend has, he said, first of all, he begins by saying that he read my book on Rabbi Weinberg, etc. And then he says he was at his friend's house and his friend had this new magazine Dialogue. And he saw that there's a guy there who wrote against me. And he read the article and he told his friend that this is nonsense, etc., etc. Am I going to, what do I think about it? Well, you know, have I seen the article? So here's a guy, he never even heard of the Sfarim blog, and he's asking me this question. It's like the example I wrote about in the Sfarim blog, that there's a woman in my town, she heard I wrote a book on censorship, she said, did I hear that the Rashbam, that Art Scroll centered the Rashbam on the beginning of Bereishit, and I'm the one who made that famous. That's my most famous post. Popular post of all time, actually three posts dealing with the Art Scroll censoring the Rashbam. So here people are telling me, asking me, do I know about the Rashbam being censored? So it's funny. But what I'm going to show you now, I did not know when I wrote my book or I would have written about it. And it's on this very tshuva. And I'll show you the book. Well, here. Here's the last page in the tshuva. You can see right smack in the middle there, a blank space. I enlarged it. I'll show you. I mean, this is the edition. This is the only edition of the Nitziv I have. This is the 1993 edition, which has volume 5. Let me show you up close what is in my edition. And I think this is also the edition on the Otzer HaChachma. Okay, so when you're, this is how you find censorships. You're reading, and lo and behold, right in the middle there. So now let's, if we're reading it, let's see what it says. It says, those who want to see it on your own, it's page 104. No, it's not 104. What pages is this? Let's see here. Yeah, I'm looking in my... looking in the wrong volume, volume 2. Okay, it's the very last page of the tshuva, page Chaf Chayin Amud Aleph. So you're reading it. He says that we should, you know, follow the opinions of Chazal, the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch, and we shouldn't change this. As you can see here, it says, Al pi eza adam, and then what? Who imagines that you know that he knows a way to be better and Oved Hashem, and then he goes on to say that in the first temple there were these people, they wouldn't worship idols, but they would offer on the Bamot, they twisted the Torah, etc. So what's missing there? So let me show you what's missing there. I don't know. This wasn't. I'd have to go through all the, like in Hebrew University, the various printings. The volume I'm holding now, the 93 edition, is just a photo offset. So between the first printing and the more modern printings, we have to determine where this was whited out. And we'll see very clearly right now why it was whited out. Me pull it up here for you and I will show you. So right in the middle there, third line, that you shouldn't change up. He is Adam Godov Kadosh Shemedame Ki Kain Ra Yoser Leonos Hashem. So is Adam Godov Kadosh. Let me read you what it says when you take it out. I mean, when with the censorship. Yeah, so the words that were taken out, Godov Kadosh. Clearly, he's hinting to Hasidic rulers. And I mean, if you go on, well, I think it's obvious to me. Who else would he be talking about that people that they think they can determine, they know everything? And I'll show you another example of this where you see that he's speaking about. I mean, if you look at the bottom, you see it. I'm holding it right here where the marker is. He says, in this generation, you have many machzikei das yirei Hashem misnagim das atzmam lahasig avodas Hashem. They go by their own view to find love of God. Af al gav she'eino lefi ha-Talmud v'Shulchan Aruch. They follow the, they don't follow the Talmud v'Shulchan Aruch. They do what they think is right, and they rely on what Chazal say, that God knows your heart. So that's referring to like if I'm a Hasidic Rebbe, well, hey, you know, I'm not ready for davening. Zman Kriyat Shema, Zman Tefillah, I could daven after the Zman because God knows my heart. And I don't need to be bound by these rules in the Shulchan Aruch because I'm above that. So the Netziv is obviously directing this against the Hasidim, and therefore the words Godol v'Kadosh were removed. There's another censorship in the Netziv, and this I did refer to in changing the immutable. It's also directed against the Hasidim, and I actually was corrected by Yonason Rossman. If I think he listens online to the classes, I wrote this is on page 225. The Netziv is responding to something that the Baal HaTanya of Shneur Zalman Avadi wrote. He also wrote a great posting. He wrote Shulchan Aruch HaRav. He said that I wrote that the Netziv stated that Shneur Zalman Avadi's arguments were only intended to intimidate the scholarly reader. That is, you shouldn't take seriously his arguments because they were just intended to intimidate the scholarly reader. Rossman showed that my language here is not precise. What the Netziv says is not that the Netziv's, what the Netziv says is not that Shneur Zalman's arguments were intended to intimidate the scholarly reader, but rather his statement that he has many arguments wasn't. So it's a slight difference, but I thank Yonason for pointing that out to me. Yonason Rossman, incidentally, is the one who wrote the book. Book came out a couple of years ago on the Igros Moshe, a very thick book in which he goes through many of the tshuvas of Igros Moshe, which is comments. So thank you for that, Yonason. In his responsum on separatism, the one dealing with the Machzik Yedas, he also throws in something of interest to us. Namely, he deals with secular studies. And he says that secular studies should only be before you study Torah or after, but not at the same time. Because he says you cannot be successful in the study of Torah if you're also learning secular studies at the same time, the German Orthodox way, the way they do it today. He says that either, I mean, the best way would be obviously you fill your belly with Torah, you know Torah, and then you later learn secular studies. But he also says that it would also work if you, let's say, studied secular studies, like a Rabbi Akiva type of person. You know, the first 40 years, all you did was study secular studies, and then you learn, devote yourself to Torah study. But you can't have it at the same time. When you study Torah, it has to be kulo Torah, no nothing else. We will come back later to his views of secular studies, but since I mentioned it, let me just refer to this book, Igros Machzei Rabbanan. If you do not have that, you can send me a link. You can buy it on eBay. This is the sefer I published last year for those in Israel who want it. It's available in Beit Shemesh and Yerushalayim. Well, in the back of it, because it relates to something I wrote and included as an appendix, I discovered a letter, a completely unknown letter from the Nitziv. When I first discovered this, I was very excited. The Nitziv dealing with secular studies. It turns out it doesn't really, it's not so significant. Because exactly what he says there, almost exactly, you find in his commentary on Chumash. It is of interest, though, in that it's you see it's directed to his grandson, Moshe Yitzchak Berlin, this letter, who's the son of Rav Chaim Berlin. But again, he says the same idea that Chachmas Chitzonios is only good after you fill your belly with Torah. He even says that Tov Hamtik Od Chocho Chachmas Chitzonios. He says it's good to have secular knowledge, just like in the earlier generations, the Rambam, the Ramban, all these. So he's not saying it's you shouldn't have it. He's far removed from saying that secular studies are not good and valuable. However, he says two things: you cannot have them. You cannot study them when you're studying Torah, and also, if you don't have Torah, then the secular studies aren't of value because his understanding of secular studies is. Not that you're going to read Shakespeare, but the secular studies enlighten you in Torah matters. You can know math, and you can appreciate all sorts of things. Just like the Gra said, that if you don't have secular studies, you lack in Torah study as well. He says that even if you need Talmud study, because otherwise, that even if you study, if you have secular study, they'll even twist, Limud HaMikra VaMusar, they will, the Chachmas Chitzonios will twist them. So you need real Torah study, Talmudic Torah study, and then you can go, and he explains it, he gives a mashal, the whole thing. You can all see this. In the Amek Davar, in Bamidbar chapter 8, verse 2, he says that there are seven lamps on the menorah because the seven sciences, there was this idea that there are seven sciences, are included in the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Because if you don't know these, how can you, if you don't know math, how do you, or astronomy, you don't know Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, you can't understand the measurements. So when you speak about the Nitziv in secular studies, it's not a Torah Derech Eretz type of approach, it's secular studies in service. To Torah as a handmaiden, or as the Rambam says in his letter to Rav Yehonah, son of Unel, that it's the Rakachot v'Tabachot, a passage which is in complete contradiction to the Rambam's ideas, as you see in the guide and in the Mishnah Torah, which raises the whole issue of the Rambam sometimes when he writes to certain individuals. He expresses himself in a way that's in line with the sentiments of who he's writing to, not necessarily what the Rambam himself thinks. And this is a point in part three of my response to Grossman, which will probably be 10 parts. I will come back to that because part two is already, it's ready to roll. Just gotta, I think they're waiting a couple more days or maybe even after Purim. Okay, a few more minutes. So the Nitziv valued secular studies, even. In a certain perspective, and he also valued science, but he didn't see science the way today we see science. For instance, in his commentary to Bereishis, chapter 7, verse 23, he deals with this is the era of the discovery of fossils. So, what to make of fossils? Someone today looking at it would conclude that maybe the world is older than 5,000 or close to 6,000 years. That's not what he concludes. Rather, he claims that, which I guess for a 19th century writer is more understandable than today, that the fossils must be of animals prior to the flood. This is before carbon dating and all the rest of that. I was surprised to see Howard Joseph, who we mentioned before, he's a rabbi in Montreal, if I'm not mistaken. He has a little book. Here it is. We're going to look at this in more detail. Why Anti-Semitism? It's by the Nitziv. The Nitziv has an essay attached to his commentary on Shir HaShirim, which deals with anti-Semitism. So it's a short book here. It's not even 100 pages. But in the introduction, he tries to give you a bit of an intellectual portrait of the Netziv. And on page in the preface, on 32 to 33, he's wondering if the Netziv refers to, or at least is reacting to, evolutionary theory and Darwinism, because he refers to in his commentary in Bereishit chapter 2, he says God made it so that he changes the nature of creatures according to the time so that they will revere him. The Netziv refers to God changing creatures. So maybe it's an allusion to evolution. It's hard to say, obviously, divinely guided revolution. He says also in I found I just happened to find this. He has another passage. He asks a question in Shema, passage dealing with Shema. He says, hold on. I printed it out, but in V'hayim Shemo we say Ki mi ha-shamayim ha-aretz. No, wrong page. What does that mean, Ki mi ha-shamayim ha-aretz? At least the Netziv says he says that. Hold on a second. I have the page. Ah, yes. Ah, here it is. Okay, I have so many things here. It's hard to know. He says, "What does it mean, Ki mi ha-shamayim ha-aretz?" You have Shamayim and you have Aretz. He says, "Hayishuv mishtaneh harbei berabot hayamim." He says that the civilization changes. He says there are nation, areas that are settled today that weren't that thousands of years ago were covered up by water, and they're today and just the reverse. I don't know. Is that's not really evolution, but it shows a recognition that of geological changes and the like. Okay, so this volume, which Howard Joseph calls "Why Anti-Semitism," he says a translation of Shaar Yisrael, of translation of the remnant of Israel, Shaar Yisrael. There's a he has a commentary on Shir HaShirim. Part of it is called Rina Shel Torah, which is the commentary of Song of Songs, and then he has this essay on anti-Semitism. And then it's it asks the eternal question, why the Jews? Why everyone hates the Jews? I want to read to you what he says. It's one thing, he repeats this again and again. He says, because of this, it is unnecessary to examine the specific complaints and reasons they offer for destroying us. It's a perpetual hatred. And then he goes on to say that everything depends on divine providence according to our deeds before God's. It is we who determine whether they, the non-Jews, will act well or ill towards us. It doesn't depend upon the conduct of the authorities if it had not been sanctioned by providence. What he is saying here is that anti-Semitism, they're always going to hate us. But at the end of the day, whether they act on this, whether they destroy us, and he gives an example, destruction in Nebuchadnezzar, and also the second temple, which is Sinas Chinam, which we spoke about. What this shows us, he says, is that really the nine nations are just a tool, that we are the reason for when they attack us and when they do terrible things for us. Everything depends upon divine providence, upon us according to our deeds before God's. It is we who determine whether they act well or ill towards us. In other words, why are there pogroms? Why are the nations oppressing the Jews with blood libels and expulsions? It's because of the Jews. The Jews are sinning, and that's why they're being punished. Many people hearing this would say this is blame the victim. That is that, but it's really not. It's not in the sense that, we're doing bad things to the nations, and therefore the nations are attacking us, or we're doing bad things, we're not being good citizens. On the contrary, it's that we're doing bad things to God, and therefore God is punishing us through the nations. But it's easy to see how people would say this is blame the we're blaming the Jews for the own problems they're suffering. Joseph actually picks up on this in the introduction on page 54, and he says, after the Holocaust, it is difficult, even painful, to read explanations of Jewish suffering that blame Jews for what occurred. We all know that. And this, but the classic explanation for everything, including the Holocaust, was always that because we sinned. It was the Lubavitcher Rebbe famously attacked Rav Shach when Rav Shach offered this, standard explanation. The Lubavitcher Rebbe attacked him and said that, not by name, but attacked, the offering of this explanation, which everyone understood who was referring to, that Chas v'Shalom to say that a million children killed, you can never say that it's because the Jews sinned. And yet, the Crusades, when you look at it percentage-wise, how many Jews were alive then, you're talking enormous numbers of Jews killed percentage-wise. And everyone always assumed, even though it's after Khmelnytsky and others, everyone always assumed that these were punishments by God. It's not like Eliezer Berkowitz's understanding of, sometimes, the evil just gets God turns his face away. And the sword is released, and the good suffer together with the wicked. Nothing like that. It was always understood that this was a punishment because of our sins. Is that blaming the victim? I guess from one standpoint, it's blaming the victim, but it's not blaming the victim the way people think of it today, that the Jews, they walk around in their black coats, and that's why people in Crown Heights are attacking them, things like that, or they speak Yiddish. It's not that sort of blaming the victim. It's a different blaming the victim that the Jews were sinners before God. It's very tough after the Holocaust, and I understand people don't like to say that. And better if you find a better reason, find it. But historically, maybe you don't have any reason. If Soloveitchik said that you're not supposed to try, just like an eel, the answer, God's answer when he comes out of the whirlwind is that we can't explain why bad things happen to good people, and we shouldn't try to explain it. But throughout history, Jews always did try to explain it. And if you really want to feel upset, take a look at some of the reasons they give for the terrible things that happened. Talking and davening, pogroms, people being killed because one of the people talked during davening. One of the explanations for the Chevron massacre, the Chevron pogrom of 1929, believe it or not, is that they changed their clothes. They didn't dress the way that they Eretz Yisrael they used to dress. Instead, they wore Western clothes and they brought it to Eretz Yisrael. I mean, you can find all sorts of reasons that will turn your stomach. One rabbi, Sephardic rabbi, I don't think an Ashkenazi rabbi can say this, a Sephardic rabbi, Rabbi Hadaya, in the Shulat Yaskel Avdi, he has an explanation for why the Holocaust happened. And he quotes some Kabbalistic source, but every now and then God has to clean out the Mamzerim. And therefore, that's the Holocaust. I mean, just think about what this means. 6 million Jews, a million children. God has to clean out the Mamzerim. He has no other way of taking care of that. It's really horrific. And here I have to say something, although his views and the things he said in recent years, I find it a bit shocking. The current Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael, Rav Aaron Feldman, he definitely is not following in the path of Ner Yisrael used to be known as the most open-minded of the Haredi yeshivot, and he's completely twisted. It's into a different path, really following the Peleg and the extremists in Israel. But I have a letter because someone asked him about this letter, this tshuva of the Yaskil Avdi, and let's just say that Rabbi Aaron Feldman is not at all understanding of this idea that it's because to get rid of the Mamzerim. But in any event, that was there have been always been sort of blaming. The victims. Well, when we continue next week, I will, or 2 weeks, I'll give you some more examples of that. And then we're going to move on. I want to move on to the Shemitah, the great Shemitah controversy, speak a little bit about that. Interesting ideas of the Netziv. Let me just get a pen out here. The Netziv has all sorts of interesting ideas which you can draw out from his commentary. I think the first one we'll deal with is his notion of Malchus. How he understands the command to have a king. We'll talk. We still have a good deal to speak about, so let's end for for now right here at five of. Let me look at some of the comments. I've been speaking straight here for 55 minutes. Get to some of your comments. Let me go to the top. So Baruch says that Lubavitch, and that's Chabad Lubavitch and Bruce Avraham, that's in Newark, they've been doing it for Russian Jews for years. That is, well, I don't know. Is it, what do you mean doing it for Russian Jews? These Russian Jews go to their synagogue. So then, you know, if they're going to the synagogue, they're part of the community. I guess you could say they shouldn't offer to do it. But do they go out? Do they try to be, you know, find Jews and just try to get them to have halachic marriages? I don't know. Moshe says, I would assume Rav Henkin would advocate it, since he holds a civil marriage is by default a halachic marriage and still needs a get. Therefore, you might as well make it halachic all the way. Yes, I, you know, Moshe, you are probably right. I asked, though, his grandson, Herzl Henkin, did your grandfather go so far? We all know that he held that it's halachic marriage, civil marriage. But Lemaisa, did he hold that people who get remarried civilly without a get, you know, they were married civilly and then they get divorced and get remarried, that the children are mamzerim? Did he go that far? And Rabbi Henkin Yehuda told me he does not know if he went that far. From the rhetoric and from what he writes, you would assume he would go that far because he said there's an actual halachic marriage. But I don't know. I mean, maybe he would have held that you can rely on Rav Moshe in that case. Thank you, Baruch. Historical Jewish Press, yes. And Moshe says, Asherah, the consort of God, yes. Moshe says, did the Nitziv have an opinion about the carrots of his time? I would assume he knew that. I have not seen any reference at all to carrots in his writings. And you asked, did the comment of the Nitziv not cause a ruckus? They almost sound like earlier Hasidus criticism of Talmidei Chachamim. The only thing that caused a ruckus, we'll get to next class. Believe it or not, in Machzikei Hadas, the newspaper, Machzikei Hadas, there's an attack on the Nitziv, on his parish. And Rav Kook's first, Rav Kook's very first article is a defense of his Rebbe. Now, I don't have, it doesn't, I'm looking at the title page here. I don't know what year the first Meshiv Dover came out. I'll get that for next class. My assumption is that the Meshiv Dover came out with this attack on the Machzikei Hadas, and therefore they get their revenge by an article attacking the commentary, and then Rav Kook responds to it. I'll make a note to check on. Because, and even if not, the Nitziv's tshuva must have been known. Shrink this down. But nothing against the attack on the Talmidei Chachamim, because he's not mentioning any Talmidei Chacham by name. He's just speaking about, I guess, the genre of Talmidei Chachamim. I don't know. But it is hard. And he always says that the Vilna Gaon is similar criticism. It all depends who's offering it. You find criticism by many people. I think the Chavos Yair also has harsh criticism, because the assumption always is that it's not that Talmid Chacham. It's not the ones we know. It's the pseudo Talmid Chacham. So it's different. Baruch says, criticism in a sefer, simai tamei chachamim, is not the same as criticism among the masses at large. That's correct. No, I meant, Moshe, I meant Rabbi Akiva, that he's just not modest. By giving an example, he didn't know Torah. So what's the difference? You don't know Torah, you don't, so if someone who knows, learned secular studies the first 40 years, he's also an Amaretz. It's the same thing. Yes, I am. Rav Feldman's point, you have to say, Baruch, if you look at Rav Feldman's old writings from before, let's say, 15 years ago, there's a lot to praise. I've enjoyed much of his writings, but in the last 15 years or so, he seems to have gone very extreme, and I'm not sure why. When I was in Israel, my year in Israel, we actually had a dinner once. David Miller from Gross Kollel and BMT brought us over to meet Rabbi Feldman, and he used to write in tradition, and so I can't explain why, and especially because when you think about it, Rabbi Feldman is going against Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky or Gershon Edelstein. He's going against the mainstream Litvisha Das Torah, and that's not what you would expect from people. Although you have the Peleg, but that's not the mainstream Litvisha view. I asked a friend today who learned in Neir Yisrael for many years, but he's out of Neir Yisrael now 20 years. So I said to him if he knows what's going on there, because and my question was, has there been a change in the day-to-day? Because you have a Rosh Yeshiva who's advocating all these radical ideas. Has that affected day-to-day, or is day-to-day, because the students still go to university, is the day-to-day experience of someone at Neir Yisrael no different today than it was, let's say, 20, 25 years ago? Because if it is different, if these radical ideas are now being expressed, then the typical student who would go to Neir Yisrael, I can't see why they would go. It's totally in opposition to what the yeshiva usually stood for. You'd go instead to Lander College or something like that. And I don't have an answer. If any of you have an answer, you can tell me, because my friend said he's been out 20 years and he really doesn't know the answer to my question if this is seeping down to the younger generation. What people have told me is that I know someone who was very involved in Neir Yisrael who's no longer involved at all. I'm talking about very active on the board. And I know people who went to Neir Yisrael themselves who would not send their kids to Neir Yisrael. Some of them would even send their kids to, say, they like YU, but they would not send their kids to Neir Yisrael because of this. But I really don't know the answer. Okay. Well, thank you all, and thank you, Baruch, for that. Pick up in 2 weeks. Next week, have a Freilich HaPurim, and see you all in 2 weeks, God willing.